going to study Parshat Vayishlach, our parsha encompasses one of the most difficult times we see the patriarchs undergoing. It begins with Yaakov in preparation for meeting Esav. He sends messengers. He gets word that Esav's on his way with 400 men. He's preparing for war, and Yaakov's very worried. Esav might kill him and his family. So he divides them into two camps. He starts praying. He prepares gifts for Esav. And he says, Hashem, please, you've done so much good for me. I'm not worthy. Please save me. I'm scared of what's about to happen. And then he sets up groups, clusters of servants, each one with a pile of gifts. And they're to approach Esav, and one after the other, each one will tell Esav, I've been sent to you from Yaakov, and he says he wants to find favor in your eyes. And then after he sets them all up in a line, you know, they're going, each one has a distance between them, meaning there's one cluster, and then Esav will continue another 5-10 minutes, and he'll meet the next bunch, and then another 5-10 minutes, and he'll meet the next bunch. And there's this whole long line, one after another, a distance of about a half a mile between each, and there's this line that goes on and on and on. And behind that line is supposed to be Yaakov Avinu, only as they continue traveling forward, what they don't realize is that Yaakov that night pulls away and plans on running away from this whole encounter. Each one's going to tell Esav, Yaakov's coming up behind me, he just sent me ahead as a gift towards you to show his appreciation. And Yaakov's coming up in the rear. You're going to meet him in a few minutes. But in fact, Yaakov intends to run. And so Yaakov tries to flee. And then we have this curious encounter. Our tradition is it was the angel of Esav that comes and fights with him. Yaakov somehow is left alone after he's passed his whole family over Ma'avar Yabok. He goes back. A few old vessels they left behind, he goes to collect them, and that's where this whole battle ensues. And when the angel cannot be victorious, he says to Yaakov, let me go. It's my turn to sing a song of praise in heaven. And Yaakov says, I'm not. Give me a blessing. Now, he has wounded Yaakov. He's hit Yaakov in the thigh. He blesses Yaakov. And then Yaakov reunites with his family, continues, and he looks up, and there's Esav coming. Yaakov's limping. And the matriarchs and the mothers, they each go forward and bow, and the children of the matriarchs bow behind them. And then Yaakov bows 7 times, and Esav runs towards him, and he charges him. And he bares his teeth, and he kisses him. We have two traditions as to what Esav was intending to do with that kiss. One opinion says it was the one time in his life that he actually loved Yaakov. The other opinion says his intention was to kill him by biting him straight into the neck. And Hashem made Yaakov's neck hard as stone. And then they both walked away crying. Yaakov, because his neck ached terribly. And Esav, because he just tried putting his teeth into a block of stone. And Esav asked him, what's going on here? Who are all these people? And Yaakov says, I sent you all these gifts. He says, who's this family? He says, this is what Hashem's blessed me with. Esav says, I have so much. I keep your wealth. And Yaakov says, no, I have everything I need. You take the gifts. And then Esav says, let's travel together. Yaakov says, no. I got kids. I got cattle. Things take time. I've got students. It's going to take a long time for me to travel. And Esav says, okay, so I'll leave some of my men with you. And Yaakov says, no. It's okay, we'll catch up out in Seir. And that day, Esav goes off, and Yaakov comes and camps by Shechem. And then we have the famous story of Dinah's abduction, and the two sons, Shimon and Levi, they tell the prince, Shechem, if you want our daughter, you want our sister, you got to get everyone here to circumcise. We don't marry into people who are uncircumcised. The whole city circumcises. And then Shimon and Levi come in and kill everyone, all the men. They take Dinah out of the palace after killing the king and the prince. And they take the whole city. They loot the city. The family takes all the loot. And Yaakov says, what'd you do? Everyone's going to come and destroy us. They're going to think we're we're coming to fulfill the promise of taking over the land of Israel. You're arousing everyone to attack. You endangered all of us. And Hashem tells Yaakov, go fulfill your promise in Beitel. You promised me. You said you'd tithe. You said you'd erect the house of worship of Hashem. And you're delaying. Now, during Yaakov's travels, his wife Rachel dies in childbirth as she gives birth to Benjamin. And then he goes up to Beitel to fulfill his promise. And for delaying his fulfillment of the promise, he loses his wife Rachel, which was a very big blow to him, not only because now he had two orphans to raise, but also because he had to bury her on the road. And in Judaism, we believe that part of marriage is that people get buried together. It's not till death do we part. It's even in death we don't part. We part of what we do is we bury a person with their spouse. And here Yaakov has to bury her on the road. He makes a monument, but he has to bury her on the road. It's disrespectful to the female body to start carrying it around when the body is oozing of all these fluids and blood after she died at childbirth, so they bury her right away. And now Yaakov has this orphan Benjamin to raise, two orphans, Binyamin and Yosef, and he goes and he fulfills his vow. But before he goes, he tells the family, get rid of the idols you have in your midst. So that's our parsha in a nutshell. We then hear a record of how Esav succeeded. He had eight kings. We hear a record of how Yaakov rejoins his father, and somewhere in there is an allusion that Rebekah has passed away. That's our tradition, that when it says the wet nurse of Rebekah passed away, it's really an inference that Rebekah herself passed away. She had sent the wet nurse who had raised her to help Yaakov in raising his kids, and Devorah, this wet nurse, passed away together with Rebekah, and she had a silent burial because Esav wasn't too fond of her. He knew she liked Yaakov better. Yitzchak was blind. He couldn't do too much. And people weren't too happy with her because everyone hated Esav. And they said, look at what she brought to the world. So Yitzchak made a private, quiet burial for Rebekah. And this pained Yaakov greatly. The idea that his mother, he never got to see his mother again after all those years. And that his mother got such a burial. So our parsha really records a tremendous hardship for Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu suffered more so than any of the patriarchs. And Yaakov teaches us how we have to deal with life. Yaakov is the patriarch that teaches us to contend with life's hardships. Abraham had his 10 tests, and yet we feel like Avraham Avinu had a life that had shining moments, and many of them. And the end was a shining moment. With Yaakov, we see non-stop trouble. You know, from the time he has to go in and take the blessings, and then he's on the run, and then Laban tries to swindle him, and then he gets the wrong wife, and now he has trouble within his own camp, within his own home, and finally he leaves Laban, and Laban chases him and wants to kill him. He finishes with Laban, he has to contend with Esav, he has the story of Shechem. Before he finishes the story of Shechem, he's lost his wife Rachel, his daughter is abducted and violated, his two sons have killed out a whole city. He finishes with his two sons, now he has an orphan to raise, and he finds that there's idol worship in his midst. He tells the people, before we go up to Beitel, get rid of all the idols you brought home with the loot. What's going on here? He finishes with that, he's going to have the challenge of Yosef, he's going to lose his son, he's going to have to spend 22 years wondering whatever happened to that Yosef. He sent Yosef on that journey all alone, and here, on some level, he says, wow, what did I do? I lost Yosef. After that, he's going to lose Shimon to this Egyptian strange monarch. And then they're going to abduct Binyamin. And only afterwards will he suddenly realize it's Yosef. And they'll have to start the exile. His life ends with the recognition the exile has begun. So Yaakov teaches us to contend with hardship. To contend with hardship and continue being productive. To contend with hardship and continue being connected to the Ribon Shalom. We learn from Yaakov what it's like to be productive, not to be lazy. In life, there are hardships. Jewish history is replete with examples. There's no one that you can look at in Jewish history that had it easy. As a matter of fact, there's no one that goes through life and has it easy. Doesn't exist. The only people that have it easy are the people you don't know. if you see someone at a distance, it could seem like they have the perfect life. Everything's easy and wonderful for them. Because you don't know. You don't know what they're contending with. Everyone has to deal with hardships. We learn from Yaakov how to deal with hardships and continue moving forward. Yaakov had sleepless nights. First he spends 14 years sleepless nights learning Torah. Then he comes to Laban and he has to spend sleepless nights dealing with sheep. And he's cold at night. And he's hot by day. Life is not fun. Ah, but there's a purpose. When one has a purpose, when one has a goal, then his life plays out differently. There's a whole big book written on the question of who succeeds in life. Now, their term for success is financial success. But I don't remember the name of the author. There was a man who decided about 15 years ago, he's going to research all the successful people he could come across. And he wanted to see if there was one common denominator. And he came to the conclusion that the common denominator between successful people is that they think long term. He went through different countries, different periods in history. He came up with one common denominator. It was not a question of education. We think if someone has an education, they can succeed greatly. You know the story of the guy who needed a cigarette after he was fired, right? You know the story, there was a guy who had a job, he was illiterate, and one day his boss comes in and he says, you know, we need you to sign some papers. And he says, puts three X's, and his boss says, what'd you do? Did you read what it says? And he says, I can't do that. And he says, you can't work here if you can't read. And he says, I've been doing a fine job until now. All my years, I've been doing a fine job. And he says, no such thing. You can't read. You're not. You can't continue. And he was fired. And he walks out of his job, and he can't think of how he's ever going to have a job again. He really can't read, and he can't write. All he can do is make three X's. And he's wandering around aimlessly in New York City, and he can't figure out what he's going to do with his life. And he says, gee, I could use a cigarette this time. Looks around. There's no place he can find a cigarette. He says, you know, I need a cigarette. He goes up one block, down another, can't find a cigarette. And he decides, okay, I guess I got to set up a shop here to sell cigarettes. And he set up all those little storefronts, kiosks, that sell cigarettes and candy. And he became a multimillionaire. So one day, he had to sign on some document. And he makes his three X's. And someone says, well, don't you know how to read or write? And he says, actually, no. And he says, you know what you could have accomplished if you knew how to read or write? And he said, no. If I knew how to read and write, I wouldn't have all these millions. What this person discovered is that success is not contingent on education. People can have a great education and not succeed. People can have a poor education and they could succeed. Success is not contingent on your parents' background. Success, his conclusion was, is contingent on one point. Do you have a long-term view of life? People who think long-term will invest their time differently, will prepare themselves differently. People who have a short-term view, so they want to enjoy now, and then they don't end up investing long-term, they don't end up developing long-term. The one common denominator, the only common denominator he could come up with, was this. In Judaism, we always say to think long-term. You think long-term, Yaakov Avinu can contend because he sees a mission. He knows there's a purpose. This isn't aimless suffering. There is a purpose. He's serving a purpose in this world. He is creating the Jewish people. And if creating the Jewish people involves contending with hardship, so be it. You can do that if you see a purpose. And this is one of the most powerful things in the world. The ability to see a purpose. The ability to know what I'm doing. Why am I doing this? I won't always have a reason. Why did God send me this hardship? I don't know. We know, having looked at Yaakov Avinu, that in his contending with these hardships, he instilled within the Jewish people tremendous strength, tremendous fortitude. We look at Yaakov and we know what we can do. There almost isn't a hardship you don't find in Yaakov Avinu. Be it war, be it a daughter violated, be it losing a wife, being a family, internal family struggle. What didn't Yaakov undergo? But Yaakov dealt with it all. Dealt with it being faithful to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't come in, you'll notice this throughout the Torah, he doesn't come in and give us explanations. Let me tell you why this has to happen. Let me tell you what you're accomplishing as you undergo the hardship. No!
Life is about dealing when we don't have that part of the deck. What we know is the hardship we're facing. No one comes and tells us, you should know that the outcome's going to be good. Yaakov doesn't know that. For 22 years, he thinks Yosef's gone. And he doesn't know. Did my other sons murder him? Was he killed by a wild animal? He's not sure what happened. And he spends 22 years in mourning and he doesn't know. No one tells him the ending's going to be happy. Don't worry, you're going to rejoin Yosef. I don't know if we can imagine the pain of a parent whose child is missing for 22 years. Yaakov doesn't know. So Yaakov teaches us, and Yaakov also teaches us the concept of hishtadlut, that a person has to work. We have to invest our efforts to succeed. Yaakov isn't only faithful to the Ribon Shalom and then sits back and says, Ribon Shalom, make it work. Yaakov actually does his end of the deal. And that's a rule in life. The verse says, V'chol asher hu oseh, Hashem matzliach biyado. And everything he did, God would make him succeed. Notice, the Rishonim, the early commentaries point out, step one, he did. Everything he did, God would give him success. But he had to take step one. He had to actually work. Yaakov Avinu worked day and night. So Yaakov Avinu begins by sending messengers to find out what's happening with Esav. Now let's pause for a minute. You guys should be familiar with the Medrash because your children will come home and tell you this Medrash. I learned this Medrash when I was in pre-1A. Okay, this is a Medrash your kids will learn again and again and again. The Medrash says the following story. Vayishnach Yaakov Malachim. Yaakov said, Malachim could mean messengers. Malachim could mean angels. And so the Medrash says, Yaakov Avinu sent angels. We saw in last week's Parsha that the Parsha ended, that he met angels and he named the place Machanaim. Those were the angels of Israel coming out to greet him. So Yaakov sends these angels to see what's happening with Esav. So the Medrash says the angels come in the form of an army. They come towards Esav and they see Esav with his 400 generals and each one comes with a battalion. And these huge soldiers come charging into the camp. They ride up to Esav, who's leading this phenomenal battalion. They ride up to Esav and throw him off his horse and start beating the daylights out of him. Now these huge soldiers, no one dares come near them. And Esav says, what are you doing to me? Let go of me. Who are you? And there's this one big soldier who tells the other ones, keep hitting him. And they beat him on the left and they beat him on the right. And Esav can't even defend himself. And he says, I don't know who you guys are, but I come from an important family. I'm a descendant of Avram Avinu. You know what Avram did to people who messed with his cousin? You're starting with me. And boom, they knock him to the ground again. And Esav says, you know, my father is Yitzchak. You know, even Avimelech's scared of him. Everyone's scared of him. What are you starting up with me? All his men are standing back, and Esav doesn't know what to do. And he's being hit to the ground. And Esav says, and they keep hitting him. And he says, you know, I have a brother Yaakov. You know what kind of powerful guy my brother Yaakov is? He's got nothing left to say. And when he says that, the people say, you're Yaakov's brother. We're so sorry. They lift him up. They dust him off. Please, we're so sorry. We didn't know you had such an important brother. You're the brother of Yaakov. Wow, we're honored to meet you. Wow, you should be well. We're very sorry. Had we known, we wouldn't have touched you. And with that, they ride their horses and they go off into the sunset. Okay? Esav's thinking, huh? They don't respect Abraham, they don't respect Isaac, but Yaakov has such a reputation in the world. He looks at his battalions, he's hesitant, he keeps moving forward towards Yaakov. 5 minutes later, same story happens all over again. A new group of soldiers come in, they charge in, they're so big, his men stand back, no one dares comes near them. Again, they throw him off his horse, they start beating the daylights out of him, same story. Finally, he says, you know, I have a brother Yaakov who's not far off. You're Yaakov's brother, we're so sorry. And again this happens until Esav gets the hint. And that's what Esav's going to tell Yaakov when he shows up. He's going to say, Esav says, who are all this camp that you have here? So the Medrash says, what camp is he talking about? He's talking about all those angels. How do you have such powerful friends? Where do you come out knowing such armies? Who are you, Yaakov? That's the Medrash. Okay, so your kids will come home and say, Yaakov sent angels. This is the story they're telling you with the angels that he sent. Our sages give us two versions, or multiple versions, to the story of Yaakov sending messengers. The verse says in Proverbs, "Machzik bo'oznei chelev." If a person walks by, and there's a dog lying there calmly, not doing anything, and he walks over and starts grabbing his ear and pulling, and the dog jumps up and starts biting him. So the Gemara says, yeah, Sometimes people are stupid. They do that, right? You got the dog all riled up. Machzik boz necherev. That's in a parable. That's in Proverbs. It says that about a person who is over mitaber al riv lolo, someone who's walking by, and he sees a fight that has nothing to do with him, and he gets involved. So then he's going to get socked in the face. I was once walking by when I saw two people with yarmulkes fighting over a bag. And one of them actually tried, adults, one tried biting the other, give me my bag. And he says, no, it's my bag. And they're socking one another, adults with yarmulkes. I was shocked. So someone saw me standing there and said, why don't you get involved? I said, I don't know who's right. Whose side am I supposed to get involved on? I get involved, I'll get socked in the face. What am I supposed to do? I can call the police. But I can't get involved. Whose side? You know, if I'm going to help Mr. A, he'll run away with the bag, and Mr. B will beat me up. And maybe it doesn't belong to Mr. A. I don't know whose it is. I don't know these guys. All I can do is tell them, guys, stop and maybe get the police. But I can't, how am I going to get involved? So the verse says, if you get involved in a fight that has nothing to do with you, And we're not talking about where someone's in danger and obviously you have to save them. We're talking about a fight where, like this fight, where they're fighting over a bag, but who knows whose it is. So you can get hit, and what you're getting involved for. You want, bring the cops. So that's what our sages say, that Yaakov Avinu made a terrible error. Had he not said anything, just come straight into Israel and gone to his father, things would have gone peacefully. And instead, when he sends word to Esav, hey, after all these years, I'm coming back to Israel, no hard feelings, I have such respect for you. Esav says, you kidding? You're still alive? Okay, I'm going to take care of that one. So our sages say Yaakov made a mistake. Yaakov actually aroused Esav because he sent him these messengers. So that's two opinions as to what's going on here. Our sages say, "Maase avot siman lebanim." So we discussed this about Avram Avinu. The actions of our forefathers, what does the word siman mean? So commonly we translate that as they are indicative of what would happen to future generations. Nachmanides says differently. We discussed this a few weeks ago, that siman lebanim means this was a way of locking in the future of the children. And so the Medrash says that when Rebbe would have to go to the Senate to talk to the Romans, Rebbe would review the story of Vayishlach. Because even though Yaakov made a mistake in the beginning of the story, there were many things that Yaakov did right. And we learn from the way Yaakov dealt with Esav how we are supposed to deal with Edom. If you look at the statements of the Israeli politicians, or the Israeli consuls, they will often describe how the relationship between the United States and Israel keeps waning and waxing. Sometimes they're our best friend, and sometimes they turn us such a cold shoulder, they turn their backs on us. I once had the pleasure of seeing the best the headlines of the New York Times. They came out after 50 or 100 years with this book, Headlines of the New York Times. So I was leafing through it, and I stumbled upon the different wars of Israel, and you see the headlines. United States promises they will come to the Suez Canal. United States promises they will send troops. Another week gone by, and the United States has not yet sent troops. Israel surprises everyone and captures the Suez Canal. You know, you read the history, and you start seeing that, yes, the United States always told us, we're coming, don't worry. And sometimes they did, and very often they didn't. If you start reading the history, they didn't want us going all the way to Beirut when we chased down Arafat. They told us, don't shoot. We had Arafat cornered. They said, don't shoot. We were winning the war. We could have taken over all of Egypt. And they said, don't. They kept promising us they were sending their soldiers. And they didn't. So this relationship where sometimes I'm your best friend and sometimes I make believe I'm your best friend, but I'll stab you in the back, that's been a recurring theme between us and Edom. And we see that here in our parasha with Esav as well. He loves him so much. I'll leave you men to take care of you. Now, on the other hand, the Mindigoy was ready to kill him. He was coming with soldiers ready to kill him. And the way Yaakov prepares, the idea of Hishtadlut, Yaakov isn't lazy. He prepares. He doesn't say, well, God promised me everything's going to be okay. No. And he has a promise. Hashem told him, I will be with you. So Yaakov prepares. He prepares for war. On the outside, he has his children wearing Shabbos clothes. Everyone's dressed as though it's a holiday. They're meeting with Esav. Under those Shabbos clothes, they're armed. They're ready for war. Yaakov divides up his camp. He says, half the tribe's here, half the family there. In case war breaks out, half of us should be able to escape. And this is a very important concept. People sometimes say, if you divide up, then there's a greater risk that something will happen. But there's a greater assurance that part will escape. That's why when Ovadia hides the prophets, Achav the king is murdering all the prophets, Ovadia takes 100 prophets, he hides 50 in one cave, 50 in the other cave, because that way he can ensure that someone's going to escape. That's why some parents, when they saw the Holocaust coming, they sent some of their kids to Israel and some to the United States, because they said, who knows how the war will evolve. Let's try to ensure that someone escapes. So this is an important concept, that we do try to divide our assets. It's an important concept in our approach to life. Chazal said, don't invest in one place alone. Divide your investments. You guys know a third, a third, a third, right? A third liquid, a third in business, and a third in property and real estate. A third, a third, a third. Yeah, so this is a recurring theme in Chazal. And it's also a recurring theme in life. People sometimes say, I got to marry that girl. I had a girl I dated once, and after about 5 dates, I realized this wasn't it. So I told her, you know, I don't think we match. I said, nicer than that. And she said, you're making a mistake. I said, I don't think so. You know, I think we took the time to date, and I really think that we don't match. And she said, you're entitled to think what you want. You're making a mistake. I said, okay, but I think we should break up. So she said, fine, and she wished me a good night. And a few weeks later, I get a telephone call from a relative of hers who says she refuses to date anyone else because she says you're going to be her husband. I said, well, tell her that I don't think so. Okay, 6 months pass. One day I look up and her father's sitting next to me. And he says to me, you know, my daughter has refused to date anyone. I said, I'm leaving the country. I don't know if and when I'm coming back. I have legal problems here in Israel. The government says I can't stay in yeshiva. I have to go do the army. And I'm not sure if I want to do the army today or I'm going to go learn in yeshiva in the United States. I don't know what's happening. I'm leaving the country. I'm out of here in a week. Tell your daughter she better start dating someone else because I don't know when I'm getting back to Israel. I have to work out the legalities of continuing in yeshiva. I don't know. I said it could be 3 years before I can get back here. I don't know. Tell her to date someone else. Okay. 2 months later, I was back, Baruch Hashem. And I was back in yeshiva. A year passes from when I dated her. And her father's sitting next to me one day. And I look up and he's there. And he says to me, I know it's been a year, but my daughter refuses to date anyone else. I said, can't you convince her? He said, no. Could you go out with her again and explain to her? He said, who said you should explain to her? Maybe she's right. Maybe you do match. I said, I don't think so. So he starts arguing with me, and then he says, look, even if you're right, do her that favor. Go out with her. Explain it to her so she can go on with her life. Okay, I asked my rebbeim, they said, yeah, do it. I went out with her and tried explaining it to her. Bottom line, I davened hard she should get married before I do. And Baruch Hashem, she did. Baruch Hashem, I was very thankful because I didn't want her to see me get married and think, oh boy, there goes my husband, I don't have a life. I was mamish, I davened that she should get married first, and she did. I went out with her, and I sat with her, and I said, look, I have nothing against you. I just don't think we match. And even if you do think we match, you have to respect that maybe I'm right. And at least go out, try. Maybe you'll find someone else who's a better match. And she did. And Baruch Hashem, a half year later, she was married. But that's a mistake in life. People sometimes think, that's the one. And if I don't get that one, then there's nothing to hope for. It doesn't work that way. Maybe you have 5 matches in heaven, maybe 15. You put your best effort, and if this doesn't work, then you move on, and hopefully you find the next one or the following one. And you do find, we don't lock in on one thing and say, that's it. When you get married, then she's the only one, right? We discussed that in our class on the Jewish home. The only one. But just like Yaakov Avinu prepares to continue life with half a family. No one wants to give up on half a family, but he says, I don't know what life has in store for me. I'll daven, I'll prepare, and part of my preparation is that I might have to go on differently. So he prepares half the camp here and half the camp there, and he davens, and he's scared. Hashem promised him he'd live. Hashem didn't promise him his kids would live. He doesn't know if he'll have to start from scratch and rebuild the whole family. Hashem promised him he will make it back in peace. What about his wives? What about his kids? Hashem didn't promise that. So he's davening, and he's scared, and he prepares. He prepares, because in life, you have to be prepared. People sometimes say, I can't handle that. There's no way. If that happens to me, I'm finished. No, who gave you that right? Who told you you're allowed to throw in the towel if life gets so hard? We don't have that right. We were put down here to work. It's not always fun to work, but that's our job. So Yaakov Avinu works. Now there's a tremendous strength when a person works with the idea that I have to do mine, and after I did mine, I'm going to daven, and the rest is not in my hands. But I'm going to work, and I'm gonna do my ishtadlut. I'm going to do the best I can. Did I do the best I can? I did. Good. I can go to sleep at night. Does that mean that the outcome is going to be what I want? No one gave me that promise. People call it bitachon, as the Chazon Ish writes. Bitachon does not mean that I feel like the outcome is going to be what I want. That's not bitachon. No one told you that. Bitachon means I know Hashem's involved in the story. It's not haphazard. What Hashem is planning, I have no idea. I don't know. He doesn't tell us. He didn't tell the prophets either. Some things he told them, and most things he did not. Yaakov Avinu isn't told everything's going to be all right. Don't worry. So Yaakov Avinu prepares. And Baruch Hashem, things work out right, yeah? So Yaakov prepares. Why wasn't Yaakov confident if Hashem promised him everything would be okay? We have a rule that prophecies for good are fulfilled. Hashem doesn't turn back on them. If Hashem says Nineveh will be destroyed, so then if the people of Nineveh do tshuva, then a prophecy about a bad thing happening can be overturned. But Hashem promised him a good thing, that he'll make it back in peace. So number one, we said he was never promised that his family would be okay. Number two, every prophecy has conditions. Unspoken yet understood conditions. And part of the condition is that you live up to your end of it. And Yaakov was concerned, maybe I did not live up to my end of it. Maybe I'm not worthy. I've done what I could, but maybe I have not done what I could. Maybe I have not done enough. So Yaakov is concerned, Shema garamachet. And the third angle is, our guarantee that a prophecy does not get undone is contingent on that being a public prophecy. This was a private prophecy. It wasn't told over to anyone else. The idea that a prophecy for good is not undone is if it's public. If you told people, God told me this, and God told me to tell you, so then Hashem says, the only way to discern if you're a liar or not is if I guarantee that on good prophecies I won't turn back. You see, Jonah was a true prophet, and yet his prophecy did not come true. Right? So on prophecies about evil things, about bad things, not evil things, so then even if what the prophet said didn't come true, we say he might still be talking the truth. But on prophecies for good, that's how you test the prophet. He gives a good prophecy, and you check. If it didn't come true, he's a liar. But that's only true if it's a prophecy to be told over to others. If Hashem tells Yaakov in a private prophecy, you should know, you're going to make it back in peace. There's no guarantee that he's worthy of it. Part of Yaakov's fear is that Yaakov knows that for 22 years now, his father's been suffering. Yaakov, who could really serve his father well, who's really going the way of Yitzchak, is not around. He doesn't do Kibbut Avim, and he will be punished for that. So we discussed last week that there was an element of a mistake in Yaakov's haggling with Lavan. Yaakov thinks he's getting a bargain. He says, 7 years for this daughter, 7 years. Well, who gave you permission for that? Who said you should have offered those 7 years? Yaakov thinks he's getting a bargain. Well, not quite. So Yaakov ends up spending 22 years away from home. Those 22 years, Lavan's been servicing his parents. And in heaven, there's a claim against Yaakov for that. So Yaakov's concerned with good reason. He's coming home and he knows, gee, I'm not so perfect. And worse than that, deep down inside, the Medrash says Yaakov was concerned because the last time he spent with his father, he really caused his father pain. What happened when Esav comes into the room and Yitzchak asks him, who are you? And Esav says, it's I, Esav. So what does the verse say? Vayecherad Yitzchak charada gedola. Yitzchak was so scared. Our sages say, what does it mean he was so scared? It means he was more scared than when he was on the Mizbeach in the Akedah. Who caused that? So Yaakov Avinu caused his father this tremendous pain, worse than the sensation of being in the Akedah. I don't understand that, but that's what Chazal tell us. Worse than being bound by his father, worse than that fear as he was on the altar, was the feeling when he realized, wow, I gave the blessing to the wrong son. Yaakov caused that. Yaakov's on his way back home. He's going to meet with Esav, and he knows that Esav has been a wonderful son. The Medrash says that Esav did such kibud aveim. Says like this. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, his father was Rabban Gamliel the prince. He says, all my life I served my father, and I didn't do 1/100th of what Esav did for his father. When I was serving my father, I wore 4 garments. I had 4 sets of garments. But when I was cleaning up the house, I would wear foul clothing to do the dirty jobs. And then when I'd go out with my father and we'd go to public places, then I'd wear respectable clothing because we were going out. But Esav did the other way around. When Esav went outside to do his hunting, he wore his dirty clothes. But whenever he'd come home to be with his father, that's when he'd wear his special clothes. You guys know when I go to visit my parents, I remember this medrash. I take on the plane with me cologne and a change of clothing so that when I'll meet my parents at the airport, I can change my clothing and put on, I shouldn't smell badly. You know, I've just been traveling for 18 hours. So I try, right? But we don't live up to Esav. Esav did kibud aveim on a level that we don't live up to it. So Yaakov knows this. And so Yaakov's scared. Yaakov's coming back and he says, look at what Esav's done and look at what I've done. As bad as Esav is, there's an area where Esav has merits and I don't. So Yaakov prepares for the meeting. Daniel, you wanted something?
No.
Okay.
No, I said maybe I was thinking about the merits of sisters, even that you can say it was okay this way, that way, it was still not so okay, you had to work around the law to make it work. It wasn't
Okay, you're fair. Part of Yaakov's concern is he knows that Esav had said, after my father dies, I will go out and kill Yaakov. Esav's coming to kill him. So Yaakov asks himself, what does that mean? Does that mean that I don't know about it, but my father died? So that's part of Yaakov's fear. What world am I living in? I don't even know. How come now suddenly Esav's willing to kill me? So Yaakov prepares, and he says, Ribon Shalolam, Katonti mikol hachasadim umikol haemet. I am little compared to all the good you've done to me. Our sages say katonti means I have become little. Whenever Hashem does something good to a person, so then that can detract from his merits. Our sages say don't put yourself in a situation of danger, because if you do, even if you come out alive, it could be that cost you merits. A person speeds on the highway. He says, I made it home safely. That doesn't mean it didn't cost you about 3,000 merits. Could be that you did go on an oil slick, and it could be that there was a danger there, but you made it safely. Yeah, okay. People very often say, I made it out okay, so what if I walk through a dangerous neighborhood at night? Our sages say, don't put yourself in danger, because if you do, even if you make it out safely, it might have cost you. As Yaakov says, I have been diminished by all the kindness you have showered upon me. That's what Yaakov says to their bone shom. Now this is part of how tzaddikim talk. A person who's a regular person thinks to himself, I've done so many good things. I have so many merits. Look at all my mitzvos. Every day I do so many wonderful things. We like to, we view what we do positive with a magnifying glass. So look at how much I've done. And when someone does the smallest thing wrong to us, we look at that with a magnifying glass too. Look at what he's done to me. But tzaddikim realize that every minute we're getting a tremendous amount of blessing from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so They don't come with this claim, I have so many merits, I for sure things should work out right for me. And this is a very important attitude. I remember years ago, close to 30 years ago, there was a mother of friends of ours who made one comment. She said, you know, I never get over a warm shower. I grew up as an orphan, and in the orphanage we didn't have warm showers. It was like a rarity on Friday afternoon that sometimes we could get a warm shower. And she said, so every time I actually walk into a warm shower, I enjoy it. It's something unique. It's special. It's a warm shower. I was a child then. Until today, when I walk into a warm shower, that rings in my head. Don't take it for granted. You remember that lady? I was a kid. She was old enough to be my mother. But I remember that line. She said to me, she didn't say it to me, she said it to other people. She said, I didn't always have a warm shower, so when I get one, it's special. That we take whatever good we have for granted. Of course we should have it. The tzaddikim don't. And that's why when they turn their bones home, they say, I don't know if I deserve as much as you're giving me. That type of attitude, by the way, makes a person very happy. Because if we appreciate what we have, if the fact that I have a shirt and the fact that I have warmth is something that I don't take for granted, then I have a lot to be happy for, and then I could be happy. On the contrary, if the shirt I take for granted, and everything I have I take for granted, the only thing I'm thinking about is, why does my friend have the newest form of iPhone and I don't? So then it doesn't matter what I have, I'm not going to be happy. I could always look around and see there are other people that have more than I do. There are always people higher on the ladder and lower on the ladder, and it doesn't matter what you have. A person could have a family, but he doesn't have money. A person could have money, and he doesn't have a family. A person can have a family and money, but he doesn't have health. A person can have health. What we have is a given. Why shouldn't I be healthy? Why shouldn't I have a basic parnasa? Why shouldn't I have shiurim that I enjoy? Why shouldn't I? What do you mean? Who said you should have that? You know how many people follow this class online and dream about coming here to Machon Meir? I spent over a decade, close to two decades, dreaming about coming to Israel, wishing, wanting, and not being able to come. And many people wish they could be here. We take what we have for granted, and then what we don't have, oh, why don't I have that? So that's a tzaddikim, that's Yaakov Avinu. Ribono shel Olam, you've given me so much. You've given me so much. So maybe I don't deserve any more. That's, again, but that view is supposed to make one happy, not depressed. If I can look at my blessings, if I can appreciate them, then I'm a thankful person. So Yaakov sends everyone forward, and he keeps telling them, you'll tell him, I'm behind you. Yaakov is trying to show him, I know my dad blessed me that I'll be the master and you'll be the servant. Look, I'm treating you as the master. And he tells all his servants to call Esav our master Esav. And Yaakov himself will refer to Esav as my master 8 times. Our sages say it was wrong of him. He should not have called him my master Esav. And because he called him my master Esav 8 times, that's why Esav had 8 kings before Moshe Rabbeinu was our first king. Yaakov prepares gifts. It says he prepared what he had in his hand. What did he have in his hand? So one medrash says, he had jewels, he had gems. So he prepared, that's what you carry in your hand, that's wealth that you carry in your hand. He sent that to Esav. Another opinion says he had a very special bird, a type of eagle that helps hunters. And he knew his brother was a big hunter, so he prepared this gift of the special eagle that he could use that would help him, I don't know if it was a hunter or a vulture, that he could use in his hunting. And he prepares the cattle. When he prepares the cattle, he knows exactly how many males to put with how many females. And from here we learn halachic concepts as well, in terms of mating. The halacha defines to us how often a husband, what's the minimum amount of times a husband has to be with his wife, depending on his parnasa, etc. Okay, so it's the middle of the night. All his men are set up in front of him, heading towards Esav. And Yaakov gets up in the middle of the night, he wants to run away. So Hashem says, Yaakov, you got to face up to Esav, that's it. This time you're going to face him and you're going to win. So Hashem sends an angel to stop him. Who is this angel? It's Esav's angel. We discussed numerous times in the previous weeks the verses in Daniel that say, before there's a war on earth, the angels fight it out in heaven. But here Yaakov's going to fight Esav's angel. So Esav's angel shows up and Yaakov's all alone. Why is Yaakov all alone? Yaakov has carried everyone over the Yabok River. And Yaakov realizes he forgot some old earthenware vessels. He's going to go pick them up. And none of the kids accompany him. And that's why when Yaakov will be wounded and he'll come back and his kids will see, Dad, you got wounded. Oh no! How did we let you go alone? We should have accompanied you. The children will say, we're never eating the Gidanasha again. We're taking it as a tax upon ourselves. It was wrong of us. We should have accompanied you. So our sages say that this is part of the nature of parents and children. On the one end, the Talmud says, Rachamei ha'av al bino, a father's compassion is focused on his son, V'rachamei ha'ben al bino, and the son's compassion is focused on his son. It's part of human nature. We can give a tremendous amount of love to our children. There's an old saying that a father...
Ten kids can't take care of one father.
Right. Right. Terrible saying, right? Right? One father can take care of 10 kids and 10 kids can't take care of one father. But it shouldn't be that way. Meaning there's an element where we said on the one hand, yes, each generation has to take care of their kids. But on the other hand, there is an element of responsibility for parents. We can't just say, they're okay, the old man's fine. And that was the mistake of Yaakov Avinu's children. Yaakov's going back, why didn't they accompany him? So the children realized they made a mistake, and that's why they took it upon themselves that they will not eat the Gidan Asher. Later on, it became a mitzvah in the Torah, but they took it upon themselves to remind themselves that it was wrong. They should have accompanied their father. Children should not be so confident, Dad's okay. Give him a call. Check out if he's okay. How are you doing? So, our sages say that when Esav's angel wounded Yaakov, this was a sign of how Esav would be able to wound and afflict and pain the generations to come, the Talmidei Chachamim of generations to come. Whereas ordinarily we would think that if someone's learning Torah, they should be absolved from all the suffering. The sages said, no, when Esav's angel was able to afflict pain and harm upon Yaakov, this was indicative of what would be yet to come. Nachmanides over here describes how they would take balls of iron and put them in the fire and heat them up in the fire till they were red hot. And then they would take the rabbi and they would put the ball under his armpit and burn him alive if he wouldn't admit to their pagan beliefs. So this, throughout our history, you know, how was Christmas celebrated? They would take the rabbi and they would parade him around the streets as they would beat him, and that would be part of a mass pogrom. This was standard practice. So there are all kinds of stories in Talmud and in world history. Our sages say it began with Esav wounding Yaakov in the Gidan Asher. So the angel can't win. And then he tells Yaakov, let me go. And Yaakov says, no, you have to bless me. And the angel says, I'll bless you down the road. No, bless me now. And that's when Yaakov is victorious over Esav's angel, so now we can be victorious over Esav. And he gives him the name Yisrael, indicative of the victory of Yaakov over the forces of nature. Yaakov comes from the word Akev, the heel, the bottom. Yisrael comes from the word Lirosh, to overpower face to face. Yaakov has won the angel of Esav. Yes?
Is there something specific that we learned from Yaakov's tenacity to, like, no, you're going to give me a blessing right now, like you're not going to...
Yes, I don't remember. In the book Beit Yishai, he goes into it. And I don't remember. I don't remember. Yes?
Where does the angel only wound the Yaakov? Why angel can can't kill the Yaakov or something like that.
So you're asking, what does it mean that Yaakov could fight an angel?
Not fighting an angel, but something that's very powerful. It can kill Yaakov, what?
But it's Esau's angel. Esau's angel. He also has an angel. Yaakov. He just doesn't use him.
What does the rap say?
Can I ask you a few questions instead of giving you an answer? Let's just ask a few questions. You're right. Technically, an angel can kill. But let's ask another question. Would an angel kill if God didn't tell him to kill? And he's doing what God sent him to do. So then, can we infer that the angel was sent to fight but not kill? And can we also infer that the angel's strength is limited to how much strength God wanted him to be able to have? And can we also infer that Yaakov's strength, if we go the route of Nachmanides, that the angel took on physical form, and from Yaakov's perspective, he was fighting a human being. He sees a figure attacking him, as the Talmud seems to say in Tractate Chulin. So someone's coming to wrestle with him. He wrestles back. Yeah. And he spends the whole night grappling with him back and forth, and neither one can win. And it's only afterwards that he suddenly realizes that was an angel. But from his perspective, and then we have to say that the angel's job was to do just that, to grapple with him all night. If we go Maimonides' route, then we have to understand the totally different stories going on here. There was no physical angel. There was something conceptual going on here in the battle of Yaakov and Esav. And Yaakov was victorious in a prophetic way before he's going to meet up with Esav. Wounded yet victorious. A totally different message according to Maimonides. Or a slightly different message according to Maimonides. But I was just asking questions. Food for thought. We come back to our story. So the sun rises as Yaakov looks up and he sees Esav approaching. He sees Esav approaching. He quickly sets everyone up. Yosef stands in front of Rachel because he's heard that Esav is interested in taking Rachel. So he stands tall to block Rachel. He shouldn't even see her well. Yaakov prepares Dinah. He puts her in a casket. That's the one single girl in the lot. And he's scared his brother will say, hey, I want to marry her. It's a good thing to marry a niece. And so Yaakov puts her in a casket and nails the casket closed. And our sages say that in heaven, this was held against him. The Ribbono Shel Olam said, you could have let your daughter marry Esav and it would have changed the world. Esav would have done tshuva. You weren't willing to let her marry Esav. Now you'll see who's going to take her by force. So the obvious question is, what did Yaakov do wrong? Who wants his daughter to marry Esav? Yaakov was supposed to understand that she would change Esav. So one possible answer is that had Yaakov thought about it correctly, he could have realized that Dinah would have overpowered Esav and changed him. Others say that the issue here was that he put in nails in the casket. And this is explained in one of two ways. Either that Yaakov should have been more bothered as he was closing the casket. He should have had this feeling of, I wish I could. And that wasn't so present. Meaning he was doing all the motions. Yes, I have to lock up my daughter. I can't allow her to fall in Esav's lot. But there should have been a tremendous pain in Yaakov's heart. I wish I could let my daughter marry Esav. How sad it is that I can't let her marry Esav. And that element wasn't there, and that's what was held against him. And others say that we learn a different concept here. And this is analogous to a person who climbs to the top of the mountain And he says, oh boy, I just climbed all that. There's a cliff in front of me. I better make sure not to fall off that cliff. So he takes a step back. And then he says, I better make real certain I don't fall off that cliff. And he takes another step back. And then he says, I got to really make sure I don't fall off that cliff. And he takes another step and falls off the other side of the mountain. Takes another step back, and this time he falls off the other side. Sometimes in life, when we take precautions from one side that's very dangerous, we don't realize that we're hitting another side that's just as dangerous. And this is a concept of balance. Churchill spoke about this. There's a concept that's hard to attain, that balance. He had to put her in a casket so Esav wouldn't see her. Why did he have to put nails in that casket? And often when this is said over, so it's said that this is a challenge that Chozrim B'Tshuva have. That very often when a person is Chozer B'Tshuva, so there's a tremendous zeal where a person wants to ensure that they're doing everything right. But in that zeal, sometimes a person goes overboard. A child says something that's Lashon Hara. So a person explodes at the Shabbos table. How could you say Lashon Hara? That's terrible. We could have eaten pork here tonight. It wouldn't have been as bad as you saying that piece of Lashon Hara. The person might be technically right. Pork is one prohibition. Lashon Hara can be much more than that. But is that a way to lead a Shabbos table? Is the child going to walk away loving Torah? Sometimes out of one's zeal and one's positive intentions, one can take something positive, do it to the extreme, and actually hurt himself and hurt his family in the process. And that's very often the example that's given. The Yaakov Avinu went so far in protecting Dinah, he didn't only put her in a casket, he put nails in that casket. Well, you know what? He went that far, Dinah ends up outside with Shechem, and things evolve even worse than he imagined. The Talmud says there's a guy who approaches his cup of wine, and as he sits down to drink the cup of wine, a fly flies in. So one guy says, yuck, pours out the whole cup. The next guy says, okay, takes a spoon, takes out the fly, whatever wine goes out with him, drinks the rest of the cup. And a third guy takes out the fly and he says, oh, there's a drop on the fly. He sucks off the drop and then puts down the fly. Talmud says that's the different approaches people take to modesty. One person, he sees his wife. She says good morning to the neighbor. And she asks him, how's your wife doing? I heard she was sick. Do you guys need help? So he sees she's being nice to the neighbor. But that's normal. It's like the fly that fell in. You take it out, you deal with it, you move on. Yeah, so she's talking to your neighbor. But there's some conversation that's normal and that's within a range. And you live with it and you move on. Then you have another guy that he sees his wife. And she's going out. And she's going out in a sleeveless dress. And he sees her going out to the marketplace singing with the guys, and she sits on a guy's lap, and he sees all that, and he's fine with it. She's going to do every type of immodest activity, and he's like, just make sure you spend the night with me, that you come back home at the end of your frivolity. That's the guy who takes the fly out of the wine, sucks off the grape juice, the drop that's on it, and tosses the fly. The Gemara says that's not normal either. You know, a person has to have limits. You know, you're married. There's certain amount that you can expect as part of fidelity between one and his spouse. But then there's the opposite extreme. Pappas ben Yehuda, it says, when he would leave the house, he'd lock every window and lock the door. Because God forbid, his wife shouldn't be around with anyone else, right? She shouldn't say good morning to the neighbor. So when he would leave the house, he'd lock every door and every window to make sure he ensured piety. Well, what happens? Our tradition is that Pappas ben Yehuda, his wife, was the famous Miriam, you guys have heard of. And she ended up having that wonderful son we all know about. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? Because he was pious, but he went too far to lock your wife in the house because you want to ensure piety. So our sages say, in this, Yaakov went too far. He wanted to hide Dinah, that's right. He put nails in the casket, he went too far. And when you go too far, so then it backfires. That's another interpretation as to why that was the response in heaven. You took her away from Esav. Well, you'll see where she'll end up. So, Yosef stands in front of his mother, and this is the great Yosef that is not scared of the evil eye. He doesn't want Esav to put his eye on his mother. Let him look at me. Let him not look at my mother. And all the tribes bow to Esav, except for one, Binyamin. He hasn't yet been born. Binyamin is the one tribe that will be born in the land of Israel who never bows to Esav. And that's his descendant, Mordechai. Lo yichrave, lo yishtachave. Everyone bows to Haman. Mordechai won't bow. Our sages say in the merit that Binyamin did not bow to Esav. So Binyamin was different than his siblings. That's why the temple was built. The Holy of Holies was in the portion of Benjamin. Jerusalem is divided between Benjamin and Judea. Jerusalem, part of Jerusalem is in Benjamin territory. Part of it is in Judean territory. The Holy of Holies is in Benjamin territory. Because Benjamin didn't bow. So there's an element where, yeah, they had to bow. They didn't see a choice. Okay, but it still wasn't the greatest thing for us. Yaakov refuses to take anything from Esav. There's a tremendous temptation today. There's an organization here in Israel, the Alliance of Christians and Jews, and people are very tempted because they offer money, and they offer free goods, and they offer gift cards, and they send soldiers free undergarments, and they send them, and they always have this bag, the Alliance, the Friendship of Christians and Jews. Well, it comes with strings attached. There's a logic behind it. There's a reason they're giving free gifts. And what? What's the name? I don't remember the exact name in English. The Fellowship or the Fund of Christian.
It doesn't say anything about Jews.
No. So there's one that's Christians and Jews. At any rate, Yaakov refuses to get anything from Esav. And he's teaching us something there. Don't accept gifts from them, even gifts. Yaakov tells Esav, I'll see you when I come to Seir. The last letters of Avo El Adoni Seira, I will come to my master to Seir, are the letters Eliyahu. Avo El Adoni Seira. We'll catch up when Eliyahu comes. Then we'll take care of you. Esav says, let me leave some of my men around. And Yaakov says, no. Yaakov knows that part of proper education is ensuring that there aren't negative influences. It's not enough that you give a positive home. If you give a positive home, but when the kid goes outside, what he's seeing is all kinds of things that contradict the education. So then it's almost impossible to succeed. So Esav leaves, and Yaakov comes to Shechem. And it says, when Yaakov came to Shechem, Vayiken, he camped opposite the city, he purchased the plot of land. Our sages say he realized that he was just saved from grave danger, and so he did an institution. He, as a show of thanks to their Ribbon Shel Olam, he did something for the public. Our sages say when one is saved from danger, they should do something on behalf of the public. So what did Yaakov do? Different opinions among our sages. Some say he came and he noticed the people were filthy. They didn't have good aqueducts. They didn't have any way to have running water and cleanse themselves. So Yaakov set up bathhouses. When he came to Israel, he said, you guys have to clean yourself. So he set up bathhouses for them. That's one opinion. The other opinion is he saw their commerce was lagging. So he set up marketplaces, set places where people could do commerce. A third opinion is he saw that their financial infrastructure was defunct. They were working with barter and they couldn't develop and they couldn't expand. So he established a coin system for them. Fourth opinion says he set up an Erev on Shabbos. How does an Erev have anything to do with it? Maybe Thursday night we'll have a chance to get back to that. When a person is saved from danger, so he has to pay back society in some way, and that's what Yaakov did. How Erev fits into it, maybe we'll get back to that. So he's there, and he sets up shop there. And Shechem hears there's a new girl in town. Shechem is the prince. And so he hears she's good-looking, and he goes to scout, and he can't see her. And he keeps passing by, to and fro, and he can't see her. She's a modest girl. She's inside. So Shechem can't figure out, how do I get my eyes on that girl? So Shechem hires some girls, and he hires a band, and he sends the girls out dancing next to Yaakov's tents. So the guys are out at work with the sheep, and Dina is at home, and suddenly she hears music outside, and she hears girls dancing. So she looks outside, and it seems like a very modest event, only girls dancing. So she looks, and she sees there's music and girls dancing. Wow, must be a festival. She comes out and looks, and as she's looking, she doesn't realize that behind the bushes is hiding the prince, Shechem. And when he sees her, he decides that he likes the way she looks. And so he rides up and grabs her forcibly and takes her to his palace, and there he violates her. And he keeps her in his palace. And he doesn't say a word to anyone. He does what he wants with her. Now, Yaakov's sons are out in the field, and they hear what's happened. So they are very upset. And Yaakov is silent. And after he's had his time with her, he comes to his father and says, I want to marry this girl. Now notice that this story is markedly different than the story of Sarah and Rebecca. Sarah was abducted by force, and she was not violated. Rebecca was abducted by almost, she was not abducted. Sarah was abducted twice. Rebecca was almost, but was not. None of them were violated. Dina was. Yaakov has to deal with the fact that he knows that his daughter was trampled upon. He knows that his daughter has been hurt, and he can't do anything. And he's quiet. And so Hamor shows up, and look at how disgusting they behave. They are unapologetic. Hamor shows up as though it's the most normal thing in the world. And he says to Yaakov, he says, you know, my son Shechem really likes your daughter. No, really, no kidding. And he wants to marry her as though this is normal. They're not apologizing. They're not saying, you know, gee, sorry. Nothing. Just, he wants to marry her. He doesn't bring her back to the bargaining table. He leaves her in the palace. And now he shows up and says, my son wants to marry your daughter. He desires your daughter. Chashaka nafsho bevitchem. Our sages say that the wording, it says he slept with her and he abused her. Indicative of more than just the normal form of being intimate. So he violated her in more ways than one. And then he comes to Yaakov. And Yaakov doesn't say a word.
Okay. Just to show his strength. That's very nice. Why not use your strength for something good?
Okay.
He would have done something, like his two sons does the right thing, in my opinion.
Okay. So, Yaakov's sons are very upset, and Yaakov is silent. And this is the first time since the flood that someone has transgressed the laws of proper approach to promiscuity. Ever since the flood, it was a given that people respected the idea that you have to have some form of marriage. You had to respect, call it women's rights or the concept of a marriage. This was the first time that something like this happened. Before the flood, you had situations where people by force would take any woman they wanted. But ever since the flood, it was agreed on planet Earth that people don't do this. And so now, something happened here. Now, I want to mention something. I don't know that Chazal connect these two points, but it's a point to ponder, especially Daniel is very bothered. Why didn't Yaakov do something yet? So number one, Yaakov's waiting for his sons to show up. He is much more forceful when he has his clan with him. He waits for them to come back from the field. And when they come back, they lead the negotiations, and he thinks they're leading it one way. Their intentions are slightly different. We'll get to that in a second. But Our sages say when Yaakov came to Haran in last week's parasha, Rachel comes out with the sheep. Yaakov walks over and gives the sheep to drink. He starts talking to Rachel and kisses her. And then he starts crying. And so we went with the Ibn Ezra that his kiss was a kiss to reflect distance. It was considered common courtesy in those days. That's what we discussed last week. But there's another medrash. The medrash says that when Yaakov kissed her, his intentions were pure. He and she knew they were meant for one another. But the shepherds, they know that he never met her before. So what they see is a stranger came to town from Israel and he kissed a girl. So the shepherds started talking and they said, gee, this world's been a place where everyone's careful not to violate the laws of common etiquette between men and women ever since the flood. And this stranger just walked into town and kissed a girl here. What's going on? And when Yaakov heard them talking that way, Yaakov started crying. He said, what did I do? I meant it in the purest way, but what did they think? Food for thought. Back to our parsha. So, Yaakov sees what's happened. He waits for his sons to come back from the field. And Shechem says, you guys can ask for a huge dowry. You know, I'm a prince. You tell me what you want. And Yaakov's sons are thinking, where's the legal system here? When Noah was given the 7 Noahide laws, when Adam was given the 6 Noahide laws, one of the laws is there has to be a legal system. And if Shechem feels he can get away with this, that means that he knows that in this neck of the woods, there's no legal system that we can try him in. He knows the system better than we do. Obviously, the people of this town are with him and not with us. And so they're very upset at the town of Shechem. So they answer with cunning. Shimon and Levi, they say, you know, where we come from, if you want to put down someone, you call him, you uncircumcised one. That's a put down by us. So we can't allow ourselves to become one with you when you are all uncircumcised. You want us to get together, you have to circumcise. Otherwise, give us our daughter and we're leaving. And they were confident that they would all refuse. Why would the whole city agree to circumcise themselves to make the prince happy? But they do. Now this shows us part of how correct Shimon and Levi were in understanding that the city backed Shechem. They backed him to the point that they were willing to perform an operation to go with him. Yaakov thought that the intention was they'll all circumcise, they will all be weak and in pain, and then you'll be able to go into the castle, no one will stand in your way, and when you go into the castle, you'll take Dina back home, and if anyone in the castle stands in your way, well, they deserve the death penalty anyways. The king stand. And the prince, what?
Not literally stand.
Yeah. So, that's what Yaakov thought. He wasn't so happy to see them talking dishonestly or cunningly. So, that's what Yaakov thinks is going to happen. But what happens on the third day is Shimon and Levi come around and they say, we came to check your family members post-circumcision. Everyone's in pain. Everyone's in bed. We'll take care of them. They go room by room and they kill the men and they cover them and they tell the women, let your husband rest now, you know, he's after circumcision. They literally destroy the whole city. They go into the capital. They go into the castle. They kill Hamor and Shechem, and Dina's in the castle. And Dina says, don't kill him! And they say, what are you talking about, Dina? And Dina says, I love him. And they say, Dina, he violated you. And Dina says, but I want to marry him. I want to stay with him. Our sages say that there is a weakness that Jewish women have for non-Jewish men. Our sages say there is a built-in weakness that once a woman has started a relationship with someone who is uncircumcised, so then she can find it very difficult to terminate that relationship. And so Dina, even though she is Yaakov's daughter, and even though she wasn't interested in this relationship,
And even though he pained her, Dina is interested in staying with him in the palace. And they're not about to hear more of this. They kill him. And she starts crying. And she says, no one's going to marry me. After what happened here, who's going to marry me? Who's going to take care of me? What type of life are you taking me out to? So I was violated here, but what's my alternative? I'm going to come back home to what? So Shimon promises her that he'll take care of her. And there are different versions in Chazal as to what happens next. One version says Shimon took her into his house and she never got married. She became an old lady in his house and passed away, and he took care of her and brought her back up to the city of Arbel, and she's buried next to him and next to the Tananita Harbeli, and that's all we know about Dina. Others say that she actually did get married, that his taking care of her included getting her married. But there are different opinions among Chazal as to what happens to her. When they come home, Yaakov's very upset. Now in the book Sefer HaYashar, which we're not so sure if it's an authentic book or not, there are records of wars that happened after this. The nations actually came to war. They said, you guys starting war with us, so you're going to fulfill the prophecy of Abraham. We know the Philistines were scared. We know that the people of Israel said, let's make a covenant with you guys, don't make war with us. Well, now they felt threatened. So in the Torah it says, Yaakov says, there's a danger. And so the Torah says, Hashem made the nations scared, and they didn't dare come up to them. So the classical Medrash says, people started saying, if this is what two little ones could do there, imagine what the whole family could do to us. We better stay away. Psychological. The Medrash says, later on, when in the end of Bereishis, when Yaakov gives Joseph the territory of Shechem, so he says, I'm giving you, v'ani natati lecha shchem achad alachecha, I'm giving you a portion beyond your siblings, asher lakachti miyad ha'emori b'charbi u'b'kashti, that I took from the Emori with my sword and my bow. So the Medrash says that the nations contemplated going to war. They thought Yaakov wasn't a part of this. We'll take down those two kids. There were other nations that had a peace treaty with the people of Shechem. There was an ancient form of NATO. And Yaakov showed up and stood at the entrance to the city with his bow and his sword. And he says, anyone that starts with them is starting with me. And so the nations turned away. And that's why Yaakov says, you guys couldn't have taken on all the nations. It's my land, Shechem, because I protected you from the nations. So that's. But the Targum translates it that Yaakov says, I captured Shechem with my prayer. V'charbi uv'kashti, v've'usi, with my prayer, with my asking of Hashem, that's how I ensured that we would have the city of Shechem. But again, in the book Sefer HaYashar, it records that there were actually wars. And there are whole fantastic writings about the wars of the sons of Yaakov versus the nations. Again, it's questionable whether those have validity, those sources. Yaakov loses his wife, Rachel. She's in the middle of childbirth. And she dies. And Yaakov is devastated. So now he's lost his wife, Rachel. Our sages say when a person takes on a vow, the collateral for that vow is his wife and children. Hashem says, don't take on vows. You're endangering your family. And Yaakov took on a vow, and he wasn't quick enough in repaying that vow. And so his wife Rachel died. Now, obviously, there was a reason in heaven why Rachel had to die. She's not going to die for his transgressions. He deserves to lose his wife because of what he did wrong, and she deserved to die because of what she did wrong. But if he hadn't deserved to lose his wife, then she might have been punished in a different way for what she did wrong. We have a rule that everything is calculated in heaven, and no one suffers unnecessarily. There are no innocent bystanders. We don't understand how that's implemented. That's part of what a person cannot understand while he's still living in this world. That's the concept God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Ki lo yirani adam v'chai. Man cannot be living and understand the way God runs the world. That's part of life. You got to deal with not understanding everything. But at any rate, Rachel passes away. And our sages say part of it was that Yaakov had said, whoever stole your truffin will die. And so Yaakov basically cursed her to die. There is an opinion that says Yaakov couldn't come back into the land of Israel with being married to two sisters.
Rachel was the second one to be married. Different understandings as to what's going on here, but the classical one is that Yaakov was delayed in fulfilling his vow. He should have kept his vow earlier. So now Rachel dies in childbirth, and he buries her by the roadside, which our tradition is that that was a benefit to the people of Israel, so that when they would be exiled, they would pass by her grave, and they would pray next to her grave. Our sages say, why don't we know where Moshe is buried? Because if we would pray by Moshe's burial site, then we would never be exiled. The temple would never be destroyed. It seems there's a very potent thing about praying by a tzaddik's grave. We don't pray to the tzaddik, but the merits of the tzaddik join our prayer. So Rachel's burial over there was with a tremendous intention in heaven. Hashem had a plan in mind. But to Yaakov, it was hard. To Yaakov, it was very hard. Our sages say there are three times that a person brings upon himself judgment. If a person goes out alone, he goes in a dangerous place. So it says, in heaven they say, does he deserve to make it out alive? If a person enters a building that's rickety, that's shaky, or goes across a bridge that's shaky, he takes on a second form of danger. And the third is when a person takes on a vow and he doesn't keep it quickly. He pushes it off and pushes it off. When a person doesn't keep his vow, so Hashem starts judging him. Hashem says, wait a second. This guy brought me into his life, right? He said, I should be a part of judging him. He said, I swear by God's honor. Okay, so now I'm going to check him out. He brought my honor into the picture. Rebecca sends the wet nurse who brought her up to help Yaakov. And the wet nurse never makes it. She passes away, and Rebecca herself passes away. There's a whole medrash about how this wet nurse was really sent earlier, and she did help Yaakov Avinu. There's a medrash that Rebecca sent her, and Yitzchak sent an army to help Yaakov when he re-entered the land of Israel. There's a whole medrash about that, and how Yitzchak sent an army to help him when there was a danger after what Shimon and Levi did. But all of that are less known and unclear midrashim. Yaakov comes back to his father's house, and he makes a deal with Esav. He says, now that our father passed, Yitzchak passes away, he's buried in Maaseh Machpelah. Yaakov takes all of Yitzchak's wealth and he puts it on one side. And he tells Esav, your choice. You can have all the wealth, and I get the rights to Maaseh Machpelah and the land of Israel. Or we can divide it differently. And Esav says, oh, who are you kidding? You, no problem. He takes all the wealth. And Yaakov says, but then I get the land of Israel. You have to leave. And Esav leaves and goes to Mount Seir. He leaves the land of Israel. He says, what a stupid guy Yaakov is. He's gotten the land of Israel. That means he has to fulfill the curse of being a slave in Egypt for 400 years. Esav says, great idea. You keep the wealth. I'll take the wealth. I'll take the inheritance. You keep the promise of the land of Israel. You get your portion in the Maaseh Machpelah. And you'll have to fulfill the curse. Esav travels to Mount Seir and he convenes a family meeting. And he calls his children and his grandchildren and he calls in Eliphaz and he calls in Amalek and he says, look, the land of Israel is an important place. We're not letting them have the land of Israel. We're just postponing it. Let them suffer the curse of being slaves in Egypt for 400 years. After they come out of Egypt, the second they want to come and inherit the land of Israel, you guys attack them and kill them. Wipe them out, and then you'll be the sole descendants of Abraham. You will have the land of Israel. And with that plot, Esav lets Yaakov have the land of Israel. And that's why we will find that when the Jews leave Egypt, Amalek comes charging to attack us. What do we do to them? They're coming from they're north of Egypt. We went out to the east, and they come chasing after us to attack us. Why? Because of this tradition. So we will continue going the way of Yaakov Avinu, ani litumi alachti. Yaakov is a whole person. He goes the way of Hashem, and he continues succeeding. We began the parasha. Yaakov has to deal with life's challenges. It's a difficult life. And Yaakov teaches us that in spite of the challenges, and no one's saying they're fun, when there's a purpose, when there's a goal, we overcome the challenges, and we continue moving forward. Everyone's life is going to have challenges. Yaakov shows us how the challenges are not supposed to kill us. We deal and move forward. A person doesn't have that right to say, I give up. Life sends us a challenge. We got to deal and continue moving forward. And you know what? Shortly thereafter comes the next challenge. That's life. life is dealing, succeeding, overcoming, and continuing and ultimately prevailing. Yaakov prevails. Yaakov builds the people of Israel. And Yaakov gives us that strength of perseverance and prevailing.